WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lara on WNYC. By the way, holiday music can be so much more than the cheesy tunes played in department stores. So today on Soundcheck, how to revamp a tired genre. Coming up at 2 and 10 on 93.9 FM, WNYC. Well, everybody's been talking about what the WikiLeaks reveal about the way we do foreign policy and if the leaks jeopardize our diplomatic relationships around the world. But there's also an ongoing debate about whether the man behind the leaks, Julian Assange, is a journalist, a whistleblower, an anarchist, a terrorist, and what journalistic benefit to the public there is to publishing these secret documents. And in the age of document dumps and too much information, do we as members of the public have to learn how to be our own editors? Joining me now to talk about what the WikiLeaks story tells us about the role and state of journalism today is Tom Rosensteel, director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism and vice chairman of the Committee of Concerned Journalists. He's also the co-author with Bill Kovac of a book called Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. So, Tom Rosensteel, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
First of all, do you think the New York Times and the four other major papers around the world had a journalistic responsibility to publish the leaked cables provided by WikiLeaks?
Well, the Times' argument in defending their decision to get this material and then publish it on the deadline that WikiLeaks set.
And I should mention that on the op-ed page of the Times yesterday, their public editor gave a full-throated defense of the Times going so heavily with this material.
Okay.
And?
Yes. I'm sorry.
And you were going to say?
What the Times said in its official explanation was that that the documents themselves are a news event, and then they went on to explain how they had gone to the State Department, showed them this material, talked to them, and that they that it was important to put the information into context. But at the end, they said, perhaps more important than anything else, these documents were going to be made public, and that as a consequence, the Times, in a sense, had a responsibility to try and make sense of them. The New York Times was the only news organization in the United States that had this active a role. The rest of them were not participating in the sense that after the documents were made public by WikiLeaks, they covered the news that was created by them, but they weren't presenting the documents. They didn't have them in advance. They weren't, in effect, participating with WikiLeaks on any level. Only the Times in the United States had done so. Now, one thing to me that's interesting about this is what the Times did does demonstrate how different a journalist or a journalistic enterprise is in dealing with these than WikiLeaks itself. What WikiLeaks has done has sought the people to leak to them. They've assembled the documents, and then they've told news organizations, we're going to make them public on the following date, and they do what is essentially a massive dump of documents. They don't do a lot to explain themselves or to contextualize the documents. They create an event, in effect, by making them public. The Times went to the State Department, redacted things from the documents. They made 100 documents public on their website. They were attempting, in effect, to make choices, to put context around the documents, to write stories about what the documents mean or don't mean. And the Times, in the end, in a long Q&A that it had with readers after questions were raised by its audience, said in terms of what news was ultimately made by WikiLeaks, they said, not anything groundbreaking in the sense of establishing things that we didn't know, but it fleshed out a lot more about our understanding about how governments work, the interrelationship between the our State Department and foreign ministries in other countries, but nothing that that probably comes to the level of the Pentagon Papers two generations ago.
So, in your opinion, are we better informed, we the public, better informed about something we need to be better informed about?
Well, I think that the Times probably is correct that this is going to happen, whether they participated or not, and that having more time to look at these documents in advance, to try and work with the State Department before the crush of news and the explosion of the reactions from WikiLeaks happens, is better than to be than being purely reactive. But it is important, I think, also for the Times to make clear what its role is in relation to WikiLeaks and to. It's also a journalistically defensible to have taken the position of a different news organization and said, we disapprove of what WikiLeaks is doing. We're not going to publicize it and make it a bigger event, but we will cover it after it occurs. That is probably also journalistically defensible. I think in the end you have to make some judgment about whether you think the Times is trying to have its cake and eat it too by both participating on some level with WikiLeaks, and then trying to cover WikiLeaks as a news maker that it's not in a sense cooperating with.
Right.
It's worth pointing out that officially the New York Times was not one of the partners of WikiLeaks. It was given these documents by the Guardian in England because WikiLeaks has some. Decided not to give them to the New York Times directly.
And the Times public editor, Arthur Brisbane, in his column yesterday, posed the rhetorical questions, what if the Times knew LBJ's intent to strike North Korea after the Gulf of Tonkin, North Vietnam after the Gulf of Tonkin was based on false information in the 1960s? Or what if they knew that the Bush administration's claims about Saddam and WMDs were unfounded? Should they have published? The answer is obviously yes, he writes. But are these really the same as that?
No, probably not. I mean, the people in defense of publication will always say, this is what the press does. It publishes things. It doesn't not publish things. But that answer is actually inaccurate and incomplete. The press every day decides not to publish things. It's what you choose to publish and what you choose not to publish that is the act of journalism.
Is there something inappropriate, in your opinion, about the Times and the other papers advising Assange on what to publish and what to redact? Are they getting manipulated by him in some way through that process?
Yes, there is some level of manipulation. I mean, Assange people think Assange is a journalist because he's essentially partnering with news organizations, and the news organizations themselves are, building stories and trying to create knowledge based on the leaks. But that's also without that participation, without the publication on the front page of the New York Times for days and days, and the Guardian and elsewhere. Assange's organization would be a much smaller one. The participation of the news of these news organizations is a marketing element for Assange. Now, that doesn't mean the fact that they're being manipulated by Assange doesn't mean that what they've done is inappropriate. We're manipulated by the President of the United States, by the Speaker of the House, by the Minority Leader of the House, and every other newsmaker. That's every day. That is part of what. Part of the journalistic tension that occurs, and every journalist has to decide, well, how do I in publicizing those remarks, contextualize them in such a way that I'm creating knowledge and not just publicity.
My guest on
that's what the Times is struggling with here.
My guest on WNYC is Tom Rosensteel, director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism and vice chairman of the Committee of Concerned Journalists. He's also the co-author with Bill Kovac of Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload, new book very relevant to the incredibly large document dump by WikiLeaks last week. We have a few minutes for your phone calls if you want to weigh in on how you think the news media has done at covering WikiLeaks. What about the Times and their particular role, their unique role, if you've been reading these Times WikiLeaks articles every day, and the last in the series is tomorrow, so it will be 9 straight days, or any other news media in general covering the WikiLeaks document dump? Do you have an opinion about how the news media has handled this? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And, of course, you can post your comments to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer's show. Ezra Klein, a columnist for The Washington Post, wrote last week that Assange is not a leaker, not a whistleblower. He's just taking the private and making it public without much discrimination, and that the overall effect will be that institutions will clam up and ultimately the public will know less, not more. What do you make of that statement? And it comes from a foreign policy liberal who has on many occasions critiqued the United States in its, you know, conduct of foreign policy and the war in Afghanistan, et cetera, but that statement, in contrast to the newspapers defending their choice to publish the material, I don't think Klein ever said that the Washington Post shouldn't cover it, but it's like it's as if people are looking at the newspapers and looking at Assange totally differently for doing the same thing.
Yeah. I'm not sure that – I mean, there's some element here of gravitational pull. The technology that allows Assange to make these documents public by posting them online also allows a wiki culture in which he can put a call out to anyone in the world to send him material. Governments may try and impose more secrecy and technical controls over that material, but I think they're fighting against that gravitational pull of technology. If Assange weren't doing this, someone else would, in the same way that if Craig Newmark hadn't invented free online classifieds, somebody else would have.
Craigslist.
But I do think that it's fair to draw a distinction between what Assange is doing and what a news organization is doing. And we mentioned the Pentagon Papers earlier. When the Pentagon Papers were uncovered or given to the New York Times back in the early 1970s, the paper spent months, literally months, and dozens of staffers trying to figure out what they meant before any publication of any of the contents of the Pentagon Papers were released. And that is not the role that the news organization has here. They are not, in a sense, the mediator or the gatekeeper over these documents. Assange is, and they are basically trying to grab this tiger and hold it by the tail.
I want to play a clip from an interview that Time magazine did with Julian Assange last week. We played some other clips on Friday. But this is very interesting to me because he's kind of walking away from the wiki in his own organization's name. The idea of WikiLeaks originally was that he was going to make original documents available, and then the crowd, the voluntarily crowdsourcing public, would get at these documents, figure out what was important to, in them, and disseminate the information, WikiLeaks like Wikipedia. However, he's soured on the public's ability to do that and started working instead with The Times and The Guardian and other professional news organizations. So here's a little bit of Julian Assange talking about his disillusionment with citizen journalism.
When I saw this problem early on in our first year, that the analytical effort that we thought would be supplied by internet citizens around the world was not I saw that, well, actually, in terms of articles, the form tends to follow the funding. So you can't expect to get news-style articles out of people that are not funded through a career structure in the same way that news organizations are.
Form follows funding. So it turns out citizens won't actually do the heavy analytical lifting. But Assange then goes on to say that once the heavy analytical lifting is done by professional journalists, once a story becomes a story, he says, quote, then we start to see community involvement, which digs deeper and provides more perspective. And he says that the social networks tend to be, for us, an amplifier of what we are doing and also a supply of sources for us being WikiLeaks. So is WikiLeaks the prime example of the future of journalism? Professionals do the initial analysis and then citizens dig deeper and amplify? Does the WikiLeaks example reinforce the need for traditional journalism or point more to the new?
Well, I suspect that the answer is both. Traditional journalism, which is going out and uncovering things and writing and putting that material into some context, is not going to go away. In fact, the traffic numbers online and all the sociology and metrics of the news suggest that the audience for that is as strong as ever. The problems facing traditional media are not really an audience problem. But journalism has always been a process of publication and then discussion. And what technology has done is it has changed how journalism occurs at the very beginning of that process and then at the later stages of that process. And by that I mean the discussion element that occurs after publication is now far more robust than it used to be. Our ability to interact and react to the news has been amplified by this new technology. What the news means is influenced more by the audience or the community that receives it than it's ever been. At the front end of the process, journalists are now able to do what we in this country call crowdsourcing, which is to enlist sophisticated elements of the audience or relevant elements of the audience in the preparation of the news. So a news organization might have a network of sources that is much bigger than a conventional Rolodex that is essentially their audience registered and identified for by expertise and can go out and say, we want to do a story about such and such a disease and treatments of that disease. We'd like to know if anybody has had that, has had interaction with that. And those stories now can be much richer and more sophisticated and more human than they once were. So at the front end, the audience is more involved. And that the at the rear end of the news, the audience is more involved. And the audience has shifted from being a passive audience to being an active community. But that doesn't make the act of synthesizing and contextualizing and digging up the news irrelevant. It's made it richer and more challenging.
Let's hear what some of you think about the role of the news media during this WikiLeaks period. Charlie in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I appreciate your show.
Sure.
My thought on it is I'm wondering how, not so much how the media is covering it, but how can we verify that all the stuff that Assange is putting out there isn't some sort of giant disinformation loop? Maybe he's putting out stuff that is actual and sort of hard-hitting and sort of has the look of some sort of a big revelation, but...
Well, I think the big test there is that for all the denunciation of Assange and WikiLeaks, nobody has denied anything that has been attributed to these cables. And that is actually pretty amazing now that I come to think of it, Tom. 250,000 State Department cables about every corner of the world and things that U.S. diplomats wrote about them. And there has been no denial that I know of from the United States government that any of these things were ever written.
Yeah, I think, and certainly the New York Times and others have suggested that that's a kind of authentication. That makes me a little uneasy, Brian, in the sense that the State Department might say, you know what, we're not going down that road. You start to authenticate some, and suddenly you're verified this. Let's just say nothing. Let's not.
But is that what they've done? That would be an interesting position if they did that. But I don't think they've done that. They haven't said, we're not commenting on any of this stuff. It may be true. Some of it may be false. We're just not going down that road. That's not what they've done, is it?
No, but we also don't know that they have gone through all 250,000 and authenticated them. They have talked to the New York Times and other news organizations, particularly the U.S. State Department, which is what this first latest batch of leaks were pertained to. They've talked with the New York Times, and the Times has come away with the sense that these are all legitimate. Mm-hmm. But I think the idea that somebody might monkey with some of these, they're not in PDF form as far as I know. They might be manipulatable. And there is a difference between a sense that, yeah, these are real, and the process of authenticating all of them. Think of the MemoGate, the CBS scandal, in which CBS was given documents tried to authenticate a signature, and in so doing, imagined that they'd authenticated the documents. And bloggers raised questions about whether the typeface in those documents even existed at the time the documents were supposedly written. The CBS News really didn't do an absolutely thorough job of authenticating the documents. All of that makes me nervous, as Charlie points out, that somebody might be able to slip something into something like this. One explosive document among many. I can't say for sure, as a consumer of this stuff, that everything in there is true. Many of them are, but that's something in my mind, as somebody who has been in the business of verification, that's something short of they're all true.
And that goes to the theme of your book, which is how to know what's true in the age of information overload. What happens to the people who don't have the skills to navigate the information?
Yeah, and what we, in the earlier era that we all grew up in, it's what I call the trust me era of news, where Walter Cronkite would sign off by saying, and that's the way it is. We really trusted brands. We thought if it's in the New York Times, it must be true, because the New York Times wouldn't publish it if it weren't. Well, now we're in this age where the New York Times is trying to catch up to WikiLeaks and can sort of vouch for the material, but not necessarily all of it. They haven't met the leaker. They don't know who the leaker is. They've dealt with Assange, and he's not sane, and we're at some remove. So much more responsibility rests on us as consumers to determine what do we make of this, what do we think of this, and there's a series of questions that we need to begin to ask as consumers, because the news organizations we use aren't able to ask them for us. The first of which is, what do I not know about this that I think I need to know to begin to make sense of it?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, our consumption of news has to become a much more conscious process that starts with this question of, what do I need to know to make sense of this?
Listeners, you can keep posting on our website how you think news organizations have done handling the WikiLeaks material at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We thank Tom Rosensteel, author of Blur, How to Know What's True in the Age of Information Overload. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we will wrap it up today with the latest installment of our holiday season economy series, Rut or Recovery. And today's Rut or Recovery question, what kind of holiday party is your workplace having? So you can call us right now with that. If you are an employee somewhere, can we tell whether there is a rut or recovery through the kind of holiday party we're seeing? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692.